and welcome to Meet the Author podcast, brought to you by Graphic Publishing. I'm Kieran Minnett-Jones. Today I'm chatting with author Zeb Soans and music composer James Marangoni about their collaboration on Fred and the Fantastic Tub Tub. Enjoy! How are you guys?
Very well. Very nice to be here. And this is our first interview about the book, so it's very exciting and lovely to be with you.
I'm honoured. How's your day been?
Busy. We've been, we're both working in James's studio today. I'm laying down the voice track over the top of James's music that he's composed to make sure that everything fits ahead of the London launch of the piece on the 3rd of March.
Very nice. How's it all changed since you first got together?
It's been a really interesting journey, certainly from the initial concept where we were discussing how we would like to produce a piece of music that offered spaces for children to explore sounds and textures regardless of their instrumental ability. And from there, this beautiful story that Zeb's written was born.
And for me, this was the first time that anyone had asked me to write a story, you know, without it being a story that was already in my head to begin with. Yeah. And at the time that James and the Orpheus Symphonia, the orchestra who are performing this, approached me about it, my head was full of foxes because I was just about to release the first Gaspar the Fox book. So I had to kind of put all of my foxy ideas to one side, and I had this blank page in my head, which was actually terrifying and exciting. But James and the orchestra had a few ideas. They wanted it to be an adventure, a really kind of epic fantasy adventure for children that gave loads of scope for the music. And there were a few suggestions right from the beginning, the idea of a grandfather and grandson, the idea of some kind of workshop where grandpa makes some extraordinary machine, because that would give lots of opportunities for sound effects. And James was already experimenting with sound effects that could be made by existing orchestra instruments that sounded like other things, like trees creaking or birds squawking. So I kind of had that to work with.
Yeah.
And then it just gradually pieced itself together. But from my point of view as the writer, it was difficult to begin with. I did find it a real challenge.
Yeah, it was really important to me that the sounds were created in an organic way and that we weren't replicating sound effects using electronic music, so that children could pick up an instrument or a piece of paper and they can just experiment with sound and texture and see what they can create.
It was to take away the idea that in order to play music, you have to play an instrument. It was the fact that you can make music and sound with anything.
And be accessible to all, yeah.
With regard to the idea behind this, James, did you initially have the idea to create a story driven by music, or was the music driven by the story, or was it a very collaborative process between the two?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because when I first wanted to create this piece of music, I knew that I wanted to present these spaces for people to explore sounds. But obviously, there's a timeline of events that then gives you the opportunity to do these in a kind of exciting environment, and it guides you. I think that the story and the music influenced one another. They kind of went hand in hand. So I had a certain number of sound effects that I knew I could work with.
I think that's the starting point for you, wasn't it? You had a batch of sound effects.
Yeah.
And then I wrote the story, and from that story came the music, the kind of the theme of
yeah.
piece. Because obviously the story is episodic, so you know there's a journey and then there's arriving at where grandpa lives, and so I wrote it in little chunks so that James could then write music for each of those sections.
Yeah, and we were able to pass these kind of ideas back and forth, and certainly when Zeb was creating these ideas, it then kind of inspired me to go, oh, what about using this sound effect here, and then I'll say, oh, you know, I can get a really good sound of a fly on a violin.
I also had to think about, because I do a lot of narrating with orchestras, so I didn't want it to be too wordy. I had to think about, although this had to exist as a book that people could go and buy, I had to think about how it would work in performance. So it is very episodic. The story is broken down into little chunks, which means that when it's being narrated, there's space for the music to breathe. But at the same time, it has to work as a book.
Yeah. So when you decided on what story you were going to write, did you almost come up with, this section will be kind of a different theme for the music, and this section will have a different set of instruments? Was that in your mind as right as you wrote the story itself?
Yeah. So in my mind, the characters very much have their own instrumental quirks. And so certainly for Grandpa, I kind of had this bassoon melody going.
I think, you know, the kind of master template for any of these narrated works for children is Peter and the Wolf, where characters have an instrument that represents them. And the bassoon is a wonderful, you know, it has this kind of slightly creaky, I mean, it really lends itself to Grandpa.
Yeah.
And you've got other kind of signature instruments for the other characters, haven't you?
Yeah, so in my head, Grandpa's a slightly kind of quirky character. And you know, he kind of sings these tunes like pom 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 pom, you know, while he's working. So the bassoon kind of automatically lends itself to that in my head. And then you've got a fly, as I say, you know, where you've got this violin that can kind of buzz around right up the top, and it's about finding an organic way to experiment with sound and texture.
And it was so exciting for me when I first heard the music. I'd written the whole story by that time, you know, a draft of the story. You know, there was a beginning, a middle, and an end. And there was a lot of tweaking to be done. But when I first heard the music that James was writing, it was incredible because it's very filmic. It's very cinematic. It does sound like a film score. It's incredibly rich, incredibly symphonic. And you can visualize the storm and the flying machine taking off. It's really exciting. And I hope that children, when they come and see this, will have that real sense of wonder.
Mm. I wanted to get away from that typical orchestral concert where kids kind of feel a sense of, I guess, reverence being there, having to sit through it, you know. But give them a journey where they are constantly, their imaginations are being
fired.
Fires, yeah, these little sparks.
And that was your brief for me in terms of writing as well, wasn't it? Was, you know, really, it needs to be a cinematic adventure. So it's a very descriptive story. And obviously with a children's book, there is a limit on the amount of words you can pack in. Mm. So that's a challenge. That was a challenge for me as well, because the story could have been three times as long, but I knew that we were aiming for a half-hour performance.
Yeah.
So that really restricted the amount of words that I used. But in a way, that's quite a good thing, because it means that you're very sparing. You don't over-describe things.
Yeah, the story becomes quite concise to a point that, you know, it'll also keep children engaged if they go to watch this huge performance with this massive sound and very imaginative story behind it.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. James, what I was interested in is why you approached Zeb to do this.
Yes, why did? Why
is there
did
a reason? Why did you have Zeb in your mind to write this book and narrate it?
Well, I mean, Zeb's voice is a given, right? So, this lovely, warm character. I wanted the story to be something that felt like you could cherish it, you know. And I'd also heard about Zeb's other concerts that he was doing. And he just seemed like the right person to go to for this, you know. And not only, I was very lucky actually to work with Zeb, because there have been quite a lot of changes and some crazy ideas. And certainly with the music, and Zeb's been very malleable in allowing me to sometimes completely say, oh, actually, can we take the story in this direction?
Yes, can you write me a little bit more, yeah, for this section?
I think Zeb's voice fitted the story because there's this lovely warm nature that we hear so often on the radio. And I wanted that kind of loving kindness to come across in the story. I always envisaged there being kind of these huge moments where we've got sound effects going on, and you know the clatter, which I knew that his voice could really cut through. But also there are these really intimate moments where Grandpa and Fred are sitting in the library, and you know there's a lot of love there. So yeah, I thought Zeb would be the perfect person for it.
No. Thank you, James.
That's not at all. And not only that, but I was aware of Zeb's other concerts that he was doing, and I'd seen them online, actually.
I think it was the fact that we would be able to talk about, we'd be able to talk musically as well as,
yeah,
you know,
I was aware that you had a really musical understanding, and, you know, it really was very evident when we started to work. I could send you little bits and you went, oh, that sounds like Grandpa, or that sounds like... And maybe you could do these kind of things here. And what if I did this? You know, would it then allow you to do so and so with the sound effect? So that was really lovely. I could just, you know.
It's been the most collaborative writing process. I mean, for both of us, I think, because with my third Gaspar book, Gaspar's Foxtrot, that was also adapted as a narrated concert work by the composer Jonathan Dove. But that was a very different process because I wrote the story, albeit knowing it was going to be a concert work. So I wrote it similarly to this in that, you know, it's episodic and there are lots of musical cues in the text to help the composer. So in Gaspard, I refer to clock chimes, the sound of London traffic. It's a very sound-based story. But I wrote the story, it went off to Jonathan, he wrote the music, and I didn't hear it, not a note, until he'd finished. And it sounded wonderful. But in this case, it was, I'd write a little bit of the story, send it to James, he'd send back a little bit of music, and then I'd rework the bit of story that I'd sent him. So it really was kind of like passing little notes of paper to each other.
Yeah.
So in that respect, this has been the most collaborative process I could imagine, really, in working on something like this. And even though the story is now locked down, the book comes out on March the 10th, we're still today here in James's kitchen in Surrey, working on the music and making sure that that's as good as it can be.
It didn't feel like an isolated process, because a lot of the time putting music to media can feel you've got a very structured production to work to, whereas this was really malleable and it kept changing, and we kind of went off some, you know, let's go in this direction now, let's see what happens, and then we said maybe not, let's come back, let's try this, and to be able to fire those ideas at Zeb and for him to do the same back to me, as I say, it wasn't so isolated, and it allowed both the narration and the music to be one and the same rather than being narration with music. So
or in works like Peter and the Wolf, where a lot of the narration happens over pauses, we didn't want that. We wanted the words and the music to absolutely be intertwined, didn't we? So there are passages where the music is just an underscore, again, very cinematic, under the voice, and other times where the voice really has to work hard to soar over the music that's been written. And that's something we've worked on together.
Yeah, it's a very different scenario when you're doing something in a live environment, because if you're putting music to a TV program, you can pull the music down where you need to. You know, if you want something really intimate, you can pull it right down. But certainly I had to be keenly aware that I needed Zeb's voice to be able to carry across whatever I did. So,
and over a live symphony orchestra.
Yeah. So that actually, at times, that kind of impacted what I was thinking I could do with the music, certainly, because I would never want to drown you out.
That's thoughtful of you. Very thoughtful, colleague.
It seems like a very unique way to write a story, especially, I suppose, it lends itself well to a more imaginative children's story. So when you're writing certain scenes, for example, when there's a big thunderstorm, when you're writing the words specifically, are you thinking which words would lend itself to a different sound effect or a different instrument?
Yes. I mean, and not in a, I suppose, not in a really kind of, you know, I didn't sit down and make a list of words that would be good cues, but certainly my brain is attuned to the fact that what I'm writing has to provoke a musical response. So I think I just had a heightened awareness when I was writing that it needed to be, the choice of words needed to be as musically descriptive and as onomatopoeic as possible. So there are lots of thwacks and cracks and creaks and, you know, words that suggest sounds.
And when maybe, James, you slightly tweaked the music and sent it back to Zeb, would you suggest maybe a different word or a different sentence structure which you think would come across better in the music?
There were certainly points where you would ask if I could place a piece of action. So if we take, you know, a chunk of text where something happens, he might say, you know, could Captain Cosmos be introduced at the end of the passage rather than the middle, because I've got this little theme that I want when he appears in the story, and that would come better at the end rather than in the middle. And so, yes, so in terms of the way the story was structured, you would often have a lot of input in that because of how he knew he wanted the music to go. And sometimes I would fight back and just say, well, you know, I've worked really hard on this bit, and can we not leave it as is? But, you know, we always thrashed it out, didn't we?
Yeah, and I certainly, as I was writing, I was finding ways and places that we could create some space and actually allow the music to tell some of the story rather than having to put all of these words in. So it was also interesting kind of juggling that and us discussing, well, do I need to say this here? Or can we just let the music say it express that it's an ominous situation?
And that's interesting because that's something I learned on the first children's book I wrote. I wrote far too many words for the first Gaspar the Fox book. I mean, over 2,000 words, and most children's books about 400 words maximum. But I learned working on that with an illustrator, in that case, James Mayhew, that I didn't need to describe everything because I can allow the pictures to do some of the heavy lifting. So I don't need to say the house is pink, the door is blue, the steps were made of stone, because James can show that. And that was that once I'd learnt that on the first Gaspar book, it was a wonderful realization. And of course, working with a composer, you can do exactly the same thing. And there was an example today, there's a drink that Grandpa tries, and there's a suggestion that it might be an adult beverage,
not suitable for everybody.
And so obviously I don't want to say in my text that Grandpa is drinking an adult beverage, but in the music, under that piece of text, there, you know, the violins can just go a little bit wonky off key, which gives the sense, that sort of feeling. So that's a perfect example that came just today, where James played me what he'd written, and I just said, well, I think we can push it a bit more and go a little bit more adult beverage.
There was also things, for instance, Grandpa has always been in my mind a slightly quirky character. You know, he's a botanist. He's very happy in his own little world. He lives on this farm a long, long way away. And he's, you know, he loves his plants and he's happy in his own kind of world. But I wanted him to be kind of that lovable, kind of quirky character that kind of sings to themselves, but you can never quite work out what the tune is, you know, the pom, 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 pom. So, that's where the kind of this bassoon theme came from, which lent itself so well to his character.
There's a slight Village Brass Band feel to
Grandpa. Yeah, so Zeb never had to say, oh, Grandpa's maybe a little bit quirky, you know, which we could just kind of express that.
Or a little bit forgetful. I mean, again, you know, that can come through in the music. So, and again, with the book, we have Anya Uhren's wonderfully cinematic illustrations. Mm. I mean, and she, like James, I mean, James is a film and TV composer, so this is what he does. He does that musically. But Anya, in her illustrations, she almost chooses kind of cinematic camera angles. There's one great illustration when they're in the flying machine looking back down to Earth, and it is just like watching a film. So she came to this project at the end, really. I mean, James and I had worked together for a while. Anya was sent the text and the music, an early version of the music. Then she worked on the pictures. But she's also brought that filmic sense to it too.
Yeah, I know the image you're on about with the airship, and then it looks down over the field.
The patchwork
of
fields.
Yeah, it's quite like intense and colourful image to kind of really visualise it. And as you say, it also allows you to describe things a lot less if the music is describing it and also the picture is describing it, especially if within the book you can listen to the music while reading the book. So you essentially get the, you know, the words, the music and the pictures all together.
And in that illustration, which I only noticed today because she'd posted it online, she has Attenborough the cat stretching out over the ship to try and reach one of the seagulls. I never described that, but that's a perfect kind of extension of his character, because he is naughty and he is the sort of cat that would go and chase a bird and, you know, or a mouse. And he's very quite selfish, really, and just out for his own pleasures, like many cats are, and that completely comes across in her illustration. And I've not had to write any of that, so that's great.
Did Anya also have the music to illustrate too?
Yes, and we did an early performance of this for school children 2 years ago.
Yeah,
just to test it and to get their response to it, and that recording Anya listened to whilst she was working in her studio, and she said it was very helpful.
Anya's illustrations, they're really beautiful. The kind of the depth and the expanse and the kind of colour that she brought to the book was exactly what I was trying to do with music, and I think it goes really beautifully together. And every time I look at the illustrations, I notice something different.
Yes, me too. And that's the skill of a really good illustrator. It's the stories within the pictures and the little, you know, the extensions of the story that's been written by the author that the illustrator then suggests. So it's, you know, this is not an example from Anya's drawings, but, you know, you could imagine a street scene where you've got the two main characters, but actually there are things going on in the shops or someone's going to the post office, and it's all the other stuff that's going on in the back of the pictures and the other stories that could be happening. And she's brilliant at that.
Yeah, I love the illustrations. They're very striking. And as you said, they kind of add to the story and possibly add different elements that you wouldn't necessarily get through just the story itself. And I think that's what kind of makes, especially the children's books, a lot more appealing, because you have these interesting illustrators, you know, working with writers to produce incredible stories. And in this case, you also have a brilliant composer adding another element to such a wonderful story, and I think it works just so well.
And also that the hope is that people will read a book multiple times, or if a parent is reading the story, that the child will be engaged enough to hear it more than once. And so having rich illustrations gives the opportunity to talk about the story whilst you're reading. You know, what do you think might be happening there, and why is the cat doing that? And it just makes it the book a much richer resource for storytelling.
And going back to the musical elements of the story, when you have such a big part of the story being this fantastical musical element in the story, how do you make that specific element a lot bigger than anything else you write in the music? How do you make that like the crux of the story, listening to this specific part?
It's really difficult, and it was a really interesting process for me, because music so often plays a subsidiary role, and it's there to support what's going on screen. And, you know, some of the best music is music you didn't even realise was there and happening, but it adds that emotion and it adds that colour to something that could otherwise be a very, very flat scene. So doing it as a narrated work, there were spaces certainly where I could go, oh, do you know what? Actually, no, because we haven't got any visuals here, we need that musical element to really display, you know, what's going on, and try and paint a picture and fill in those spaces where words couldn't, and also where we may not have any illustration at that point. So it was incredibly interesting for me. And there were lots of moments where I kind of overwrote, actually, and I decided, no, do you know what? I can come back there and just, you know, less is more, and allow nothing to happen and just let people absorb it for themselves, rather than kind of feeding them every single event that's happening and every single action. But also I wanted there to be a sense of fun throughout the score. And I wanted there to be a kind of very obvious textures and key changes and events where people went, oh, okay, something different's happening now. And not only that, but it was incredibly fun to go, okay, how am I going to create the sound of something being really clumsy without it being too heavy? Or, you know, how am I going to explore this loving relationship that Grandpa and Fred share, but always keep Grandpa slightly on the mysterious side?
I think the way that you illustrate the different scenes and the kind of chapter marks, I suppose. So, you know, it's like in a book, you know, you get the little symbol that tells you it's a new chapter. You do that musically very well. And I think that helps to, that hopefully will help to keep children's attention in the concert hall, because there's never too much of anything. And there's always a change coming, I think.
That was quite a difficult process as well, because the story has to move quite fast, because we, you know, we have a limited time. You know, we didn't want it to be a really long piece. We wanted to keep it to about half an hour, that attention span, you know, but give kids this kind of wondrous journey that they would be hopefully, you know, gripped from the moment it starts to the end. So I always had to be aware that, okay, we're moving to a new bit of story, we're moving to a new bit of the story. And sometimes it was quite difficult. We actually talked about adding a little pause and just letting the narration do things for a while, and you know, just allowing that music to settle before we could then move on to the next scene. So that certainly was really interesting about our collaborative process, because normally you wouldn't have that option. So
when you came to writing about this mystical tub, what were you kind of imagining that would sound like? And then how do you work together with James to kind of create this sound and the description for it? Was there like an idea in mind?
I had imagined the plant was some kind of organic pipe organ, you know, and I imagined these great tubers coming out of the ground, you know, tubers in the botanical sense, and almost like pitcher plants, you know, carnivorous tubes, and great elephant shaped, like elephant's ears that wind that could catch the wind like sails. So I was trying to kind of technically think about how this botanical instrument might be built, created, and then the sort of sound it would create. So there's a very eerie musical instrument called the water harmonica. And it's basically the edges of glasses being rubbed, but in a machine, and it creates a really spooky. It used to be used quite a lot in horror films, didn't
yeah.
it? It's a very particular sound. So I kind of imagined that with also the sound of wind blowing over tubes. I wanted it to sound very otherworldly.
Yeah, and so obviously receiving that bit of text was then really interesting, because we hadn't discussed that. That was the first time
I said, that's what I want, and now it's over to you.
So we've got this wonderful contraption that's coming out of the ground. So that was really hard. You know, how do you create the sound of something no one's heard before?
And we should say that at this very moment in time, you're still working on that.
I am. I'm still tweaking it. And it's this kind of organic, again, process. And I won't spoil where it's going, but we've actually found a really, as I say, organic way now that we can show resonance, and we can talk about botanical resonance.
I think we could probably say that it may be the first time a plant has had a solo spot
in an orchestra.
Yeah. And that's all we're going to say.
Yeah.
But it's very exciting.
I don't know how you make a sound that no one's heard before, but I'm excited to hear what you come up with. Very unique.
I think that was also a really interesting area of the book, because as we say, we wanted it to be a resource as well, that kids could go away and explore sound. The whole idea of this story is an exploration of sound, regardless of musical ability. So,
and bringing in the plastic waste theme, obviously that gave a lot of scope for, you know, making instruments from waste, you know, shakers, you know, trumpets from bits of garden hose. So there's a lot of scope in the classroom, I think, for teachers to explore ways of making instruments.
Yeah. So having something that we've never heard before then gives this completely blank canvas to children to go, what does it sound like to you? You know, and it enables them to use their imagination and go, oh, well, I think it would sound like this. So I didn't want to kind of go, right, we're going to set this in stone. No, this is the way it sounds, because it's, you know, it's all about experimenting and finding creativity and what, you know, what works for you.
Yeah. And then the hope would be that children would create their own sound and think, this is what I think it sounds like. Yeah. This is what I think it sounds like. So then moving on to that kind of element of the book, how do you think this story and then, of course, the music accompanying it, how can that be used in classrooms? What areas do you think of the curriculum this story could touch upon, and how could it kind of help educate?
I think if we start with the story, first of all, I think there are lots of different ways. I mean, in terms of geography, I think, you know, there's lots of scope to look at maps. And in my mind, the island of Papanupi is based in the North Pacific. And the whole ecological theme for this, the idea of an island that in which all the islanders make everything from waste plastic, was because at the time that I was first sitting down to write the story, Blue Planet 2 was aired, and we were all shocked to see images of animals wrapped up in plastic waste. And almost, I mean, not overnight, but in a very short space of time, plastic drinking straws were removed from restaurants, and we now use paper cups at water fountains. And I think it's probably had the fastest change in our shopping and our behaviours of any movement, I think, really. And that's a wonderful thing. So I think those ecological themes can certainly be taken up in the classroom. At the back of the book, there are lots of ideas for how you can reuse the plastic that you have at home. Botanically, you can make planters, you can make watering cans, terrariums. So that's a practical thing that can be made at school. I've also filled the story with lots of little Easter eggs for teachers. So Captain Cosmos is named after the book by the great scientist, explorer, and plant hunter Alexander von Humboldt. Now, he believed that everything in nature was interconnected. That's not a new idea now, but it was a new idea back in 1799. And he was the first person to link climate change, which was a new idea then, to humans, that we could have an impact on our environment that changed everything. So that's where Cosmos comes from. The name of the boat that is shipwrecked on the island, that the island has first arrived on, is Theophrastus. Now, he was a Greek philosopher and is considered to be the father of botany. He came up with the way of classifying different plant species long before Linnaeus, everybody talks about Linnaeus as being the person who, you know, gave Latin names to plants, but Theophrastus was there first. So, I mean, these are very big words for children, but they're there, and you don't need to know what they mean, but they are opportunities for discussion in the classroom, or for a child to think, oh, what does that mean? And then go and look it up. And when I was a child reading, I liked not being patronized. I liked thinking that someone was writing for me who trusted that, you know, I think you always have to not talk down to children or adults, but always aim to raise up and stretch your audience, I think, in whatever you're doing. And I'm sure that's the same for a composer with music.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did notice the Theophrastus reference, and I was wondering, with all obviously the references, is the pet cat David Attenborough, is that a reference to Blue Planet 2, which you watched?
No, yes, totally, entirely. And it just made me laugh. I thought, why not name the cat Sir David Attenborough? Because, well, for a start, I have always strongly believed in giving animals human names because it makes me laugh. So I've always wanted to have a dog called Richard and a cat called Peter. And I think Colin and Ian are very good names for domestic pets. So to actually kind of take that one stage further and name a domestic cat after, you know, a knighted broadcaster really made me smile. And so he's Sir David Attenborough in the first instance, and then just Attenborough the cat after that.
I think it says quite a lot about Grandpa's character as well.
Oh, yes.
He's called his cat, yeah. Sir David Attenborough.
Well, there was a famous actress called Beryl Reed, and a character actress, and she named all of her cats, and she had millions of cats, but they were all named after her knighted actor friends. So she had Sir Laurence Olivier, Sir Alec Guinness, and Sir John Gielgud. And I suppose that was probably somewhere in the back of my mind.
Are the references something that you always like to include? Is that something you thought about in advance? Like, maybe I'll make a character this, or maybe I'll put this?
No. The cat came along, and then the cat needed a name. And so, I didn't think, I'm going to name a character Sir David Attenborough. No, that is, it's just ideas pop into your head and you just latch upon them.
And does Sir David Attenborough know he is now a cat? In a children's book.
He does. He has seen the book. I had two lovely letters from him, and he was very gracious.
I'm sure he loves being a cat in a book. That's like the best character.
Well, he was a ship was named. No, was it? They were going to name. They did name an exploratory vessel. It was going to be called something ridiculous, that's wasn't right. it? And then they changed it. So he's had inanimate objects named after him. So.
So in terms of the story itself, we've touched upon it very briefly, but as like an elevator pitch for the story, how would you kind of describe it if a children were to, be on the fence about maybe reading it?
Fred is a little girl and her father works in a hospital. So she is sent away over the summer to stay with her grandfather who lives in the country. Grandfather is a botanist. And so he explores plants and grows plants. And one evening he shows her a map to a mysterious island and a plant that is legend has only blooms once every 200 years. She thinks this is nonsense, but he says the legend has it that the plant can produce music so beautiful that it just brings about peace. And even the animals in the trees stop singing in order to hear this beautiful music. She goes to bed and then discovers that grandfather has been building a flying machine in one of his greenhouses that she's never been allowed to go into. And he takes her off in search of the Isle of Papanupi, and they arrive and find this extraordinary plant and record the sound for all the world to hear. So in a nutshell, that is the story. But there's lots of other little things along the way. I've never had to do that, but I've never had to condense it in.
Oh, that was very good.
That sounded very rehearsed. I thought you'd done that 100 times.
No.
Very concise.
And with a really important message as well.
And an important message, which is the ecological message, which is when they reach the island, the beach is entirely made from little bits of washed up plastic. Everything the islanders wear, they're a bit like South Sea Wombles. They make all their clothing from bits of plastic. That's an 80s TV reference, boys and girls. But they're a bit like South Sea Wombles. But it's becoming a problem because as fast as they're using this plastic, more is washing up. And so in Fred putting the sound of the tub tub out on social media, the world's governments are made aware of the crisis facing this island and something is done about it. And actually, that's another thing that I hope will be a discussion point, because I don't resolve that. I just say at the end of the story that all the world's governments were meeting to have a very serious talk about it. So then the discussion can be, what do you think they did? And what do you think we need to do to solve this problem?
And there's some very nice activities and things in the back of the book to kind of start kids imagining how to reuse plastics.
Yeah. And carry a water bottle with you. Don't buy bottled water and carry a reusable bag. All the messages that are out there and we know, but it's just, listing them in a very concise, practical way. Just maybe 5 steps that right now, today, you can do to make a change in your life. Because sometimes big issues like global warming and pollution seem so big that it's hard to know what we can do to solve them. But the message in the book is, you only have to make one small little change. And if everybody makes one small little change, the effect can be enormous.
Yeah. Mm. And there's so many different ways to use plastic bottles for plants.
Yes. Who knew?
Yeah.
There's so many more than I thought there were. Were those ones that that you've come up with, you've tried, or was that?
Yes. I came up with a list of options for Anya. In fact, many more than she illustrated, because we were limited on the amount of space. So I said, look, here are some ideas, and pick the ones that you think will be the most fun to illustrate, or the ones that you think are actually the ones that children will enjoy making the most.
And we also managed to get that in the music as well.
You did. Yes, there are instruments made from plastic.
Yeah, because we wouldn't always have that visual maybe to hand when we're performing this, in a concert hall. We wanted to include, plastic that had been reused in the score. So there's a moment where they're marching across the island, and we've got hosepipe horns, and we've
got water cooler bottle drums.
And it's as a visual kind of element. It's really nice because these, the instrumentalists put their instruments down and pick up these really obscure.
And I think it's always great to see an orchestra, which you imagine to be quite a kind of serious and staid entity, having fun and enjoying themselves. So for the percussionists to get up and start playing bits of rubbish is always quite fun to see.
Did you have fun trying to put those together and coming up with those instruments?
And that was something that we to'd and fro'd about, didn't we?
And it was, you never quite know how it's going to sound until you do it, and you have everybody in one room. And the orchestra we work with, Orpheus Sinfonia, were fantastic. The musicians just went for it, and they went for it in a way that was totally over the top, which if I'd had... maybe some different musicians in there who perhaps went, okay, I'm going to play this, in a very rigid way, it wouldn't have sounded the same. So it was really nice to see them also enjoying and creating sound, that they weren't used to doing. You hand a violinist a water cooler bottle drum, and they kind of go, what's this? And then they start hitting it going, I can do this, So again... even professional musicians were finding ways to explore
and play
sounds. So.
In terms of the characters, then, Zeb, are Fred and Grandpa based on anyone? Do you base your characters on people, or are they just your imagination?
The characters of Grandpa and Fred were completely made up. I definitely knew that I wanted the main character, Fred, to be a little girl, but calling her Fred, I thought, was quite cool, and also was not gender specific, which I didn't want to make a big deal about, but I think is really important. I think it's very important that children's books and picture books are representative, and in my writing, I want them to encompass all of life. And in the first Gaspar the Fox book, it was very important for me that there was a pictorial representation of a happy gay couple, and not a big deal was made of it, that they were just there, they were just in the book, and you could either see it or not see it. It wasn't banging you over the head with it. So in the Tub Tub, I really wanted Fred to, to be a tomboy, to have an adventure. So that was very important to me. And there was no discussion about it, really. We all thought that was something that we wanted for the main character.
All I wanted to do with the music was to try and express her excitement and her childhood innocence, and the excitement of that, the school bell going at the end of the day and going, yeah, I'm off to Grandpa's, and then you're on this journey. So the music wasn't affected by... gender, certainly.
In the way that the theme for Peter and Peter the Wolf is very much a boyish melody, it's very much a boy going off into the wood, with his lasso, and it's got a very masculine feel, I think. And your writing for Fred isn't. It's just the emotions. It's excitement, it's anticipation. And I think this is entirely accidental. I think it's, I don't think it's something that you've probably thought about. It just, you've written her feelings rather than a superficial character description.
Yeah, I think for me, certainly, the music portrays a character's quirks and their mood, and not necessarily their gender.
I suppose we're talking about avoiding stereotypes, aren't we?
Yeah.
So either in writing or in sound, I think,
And there's a really beautiful page when she kind of goes to bed in the attic and then the cat's sleeping on her and she has all these quirky things in her bedroom. Are those pictures, obviously they explore kind of more of the world without you specifically having to say it. Are those things that you would have discussed with Anya in your illustration, or did she have free reign?
No, I didn't. That completely came from Anya, and the idea of this kind of den, which the attic bedroom has become in the illustrations, with this there's a bookshelf that almost looks like it's kind of growing up the wall, almost like a tree. And as soon as I saw it, I thought, I want to go to sleep there. You know, it looks like a really fun bedroom. And I'm still spotting things in Anya's illustrations, and particularly in her collage that she's done. She wanted to make the book look like Fred's scrapbook that she's put together at the end of this adventure that she has with Grandpa. So there are little packets of seeds taped in there and leaves, and that was Anya's idea. And I think it's wonderful and makes it really special and exciting to look at.
It's a great way to frame the story, I suppose, as a scrapbook, because it does give the idea more of this is an adventure. And then all the extra things she includes is just kind of an extra part of that story.
Yes, and is a continuation of the story, you know.
Yeah, the first time I saw Anya's illustrations, it was really funny. I went, oh, that's exactly how I imagined it would be. And it's so detached, actually, from anything. But in my brain, I guess, the colour, and suddenly it brought this to life. And I went, oh, no, that is, yeah, no, that's the bedroom that she sleeps. Oh, that's, yeah. And it kind of, it all came together, whereas before all of these images, I'd had to kind of create this storyboard in my mind. So it was really, really interesting when these things I suddenly saw kind of drawn. Well,
it's magical to see a world that's only existed in your head on a piece of paper. I mean, it's always magical. And when it is better than what you imagined yourself, I mean, that's the mark of a wonderful illustrator.
Exactly. It really beautiful book. Are there any plans for future books within this world, maybe on different environmental issues or different stories with different music? Is there any ideas or plans for future books in this kind of same series?
Well, I'd be very happy to discuss that, James.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what I really like about Fred and Fantastic Tub Tub is it's kind of open-ended. And that's not open-ended in order to invite
a sequel. No.
It's actually to get people thinking and going, well, oh yeah, you know, they're having these discussions, so what's happening about it? You know, and it raises that awareness. I won't say never.
So there are possibilities for more Fred's adventures.
There are always possibilities.
Interesting. So when does this book come out, and where can people find it if they want to pick it up or listen to the concert?
You can find the book in all good independent bookshops from March the 10th. It's available to pre-order now. So if you can't wait to get your hands on it, or you want to be one of the first to get your hands on it, you can place your order now. The first concert performance is going to be on March the 3rd on World Book Day in London.
Yeah, really, really exciting. We've got a number of school children, and we've had to try and find a venue that could accommodate them all, who are coming along and are actively participating as we're performing the score. So there are moments when they will be waving things to create the sound of the storm, and they
birds.
Be creating their own little shakers and bits and pieces that they can march through the auditorium when we're doing our Islander March. So there's lots of areas in it musically that they can be involved in. And not only that, but we've got a resource that we've presented all the teachers with that looks at all the other areas we discussed. So flying machine, you know, how talking about flight, talking about botanical science. So they're actually doing quite a lot of research prior to coming and hearing the story live. So hopefully when they hear about Captain Cosmos, they go, oh yeah, I know why he's called Captain Cosmos.
And there'll be a recording of the story in time, which you'll be able to listen to along with reading the book, and then a concert tour, we hope, where the public will be able to come along, and children will be able to come and see it at theatres and concert halls close to where they live.
Amazing. Sounds like it'll be a big launch and a lot of work for you guys. An incredible book. I look forward to hearing the concert, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you, Kieran, and thank you for our first interview on the
You
subject.
Are very welcome.
We'll have to try and remember our answers next time.
Just recycle them over and over. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks,
Have
Kieran.
A wonderful day.
Thank you.
Lovely. You too. Thanks for your time. Cheerio.
Thank you to Zeb Soans and James Marangoni for coming on Meet the Author podcast, talking about their collaboration on the book Fred and the Fantastic Tub Tub, published by Graphic. Written by Zeb Soans. Illustrated by Anya Uren, the music was composed by James Marangoni and performed by Orpheus Symphonia. Copies of the book are available from local bookshops or online at graphic.com, and you can listen to the music by scanning the QR code inside the book. This is Graphic Publishing's Meet the Author podcast, produced and presented by me, Kieran Minetta-Jones. If you enjoy, please share this podcast and leave us a review so more people can hear about the fascinating stories from the authors themselves.